welcome to our first episode of She Run the World podcast. So basically what we're trying to do here is to talk to women around Georgetown and around the DC area. So we're talking to professors and chaplains and grad students and professionals about what their careers are like, what they do, and what it's like to be a woman in those fields. So our mission statement is to educate about future careers, promote gender equality within the workplace, and to inspire the women of Georgetown. I'm Kai.
I'm Emily, the co-host.
And today we have Cassie Herbert here, and we're going to be talking about grad school and intersectionality. So Cassie Herbert is a grad student here at Georgetown who is finishing up her PhD in philosophy. She studied philosophy and politics at Bates College in Maine for undergrad, worked at a political nonprofit in Montana for a few years, and then began grad school here. Cassie works in social philosophy of language, which pulls together philosophy of language and social philosophy, particularly issues about injustice and oppression. Her dissertation is titled Exclusionary Speech and Constructions of Community, and is about derogatory terms and how we use speech acts to create in-groups and out-groups in our social world. Cassie teaches courses on intersectionality, language and power, environmental injustice, sex and sexuality, and bioethics. Welcome, Cassie.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself, how you got interested in philosophy, why you came to Georgetown?
So when I was really a little kid, I always had this idea of I wanted to make the world a better place, which I think many of us sort of have that aspiration. But I also had these like intense waking nightmares that maybe what I thought was better was going to turn out to actually be like really bad for the world. Right? It's this idea of being like so wrong about the things that we care about was something that really stuck with me. So originally I started studying political theory, and it's like, okay, that's one way to make the world better, but just sort of raise the question of like, what are we aiming towards? And so that's how I ended up getting into philosophy, was trying to figure out, okay, so what is justice? What are we sort of hoping to accomplish? How can we figure out if maybe we are on the wrong track? And also thinking about like the unintentional harms that we might be committing. And so that's really how I got interested in philosophy. And I took a couple years off after college to go work in political nonprofits, because that seemed like one interesting path I could go down. But I found that I just kept thinking about all of these puzzles in philosophy. And so that was sort of a good sign to me that I should go back to grad school and really pursue these ideas.
And why did you come to Georgetown specifically?
So when I was looking at different graduate programs, I noticed that some of the grad students I met at other schools were just intensely miserable. And sort of there's this stereotype that grad school is supposed to be this horrific experience, that you're supposed to be miserable, that you're supposed to be sort of a starving grad student for the entire time. And that seemed like a very bad way to spend my 20s. Yeah. And so at Georgetown, people actually seemed kind of happy, and that seemed like a nice thing. There's actually sort of a sense of community, and that was another thing I was really attracted to. And then also, there were people here who really worked in areas that I was interested in. So Georgetown happens to be very, very, very good at thinking about social philosophy. We're one of the places where you can do these sort of interesting applied projects, and that really caught my attention. It's one of the things I wanted to be able to pursue.
Oh, that's true, because like one of the things that really surprised me as an undergrad was how involved the grad students are with like our campus life, mm-hmm. and like I even have classes with grad students, which I never expected. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's a little like unique to Georgetown in a way.
Yeah, and thinking about the different ways that folks sort of at all different in all these different roles at the university can still be part of campus life, can still be part of the community, is I think a really important part of being in school.
Yeah, definitely. And you talked about how, like, a lot of times grad students feel like they have to be miserable. So, like, why even pursue a graduate degree, you know? And I've talked to a lot of people about this, and I've had mixed responses about why people pursue graduate degrees. And a lot of times it's, like, the perception that they have to get, like, to the next level, you know, in their careers. Do you think that's the way to do it?
I think it depends a lot on both what field you're working in and whether you're thinking about master's programs or PhD programs. I think that increasingly getting a master's is sort of viewed as something that you have to do in order to sort of be seen as, you know, knowing your field or something like that. So it's starting to be seen as more of an obligation than something that people are genuinely interested in pursuing. PhDs, I think, are a little bit different, because usually if you're going to get a PhD, it means that you're going into research. Not always, but it usually means that you're doing something where you actually need to have the PhD in order to do whatever it is that you're interested in. Mm-hmm. So I think that carving up those two different parts of grad school is sort of helpful. At least for what I want to do, you really have to have a PhD in philosophy. So it was, I mean, you can't do that much with a master's in philosophy. You can't do that. I mean, you can't really pursue philosophy without a PhD in it. And so if I wanted to do philosophy, grad school was the way to go for me.
Yeah. It just seems to me like our society just keeps raising mm-hmm. the minimum of like what we have to do. So it used to be that, you know, a high school diploma was enough to get like a decent like living wage, and now it's the norm is to get a college degree and increasingly a master's degree.
And that's just, it both takes up years of your life, and people are going into massive student debt. And I think that that's something we should be considering. One of the nice things about PhD programs, at least the vast majority of them, is that you actually don't have to pay to go to them. So you, as long as they're giving you a livable stipend, most PhD programs have you doing either teaching or TAing, some kind of service to the university, and you get a stipend to live on. It's not much, so you're not going to be like living an extravagant life or anything, but hopefully you don't really go into much debt while you're getting your PhD, which I think is actually a point in its favor as opposed to some of the master's programs, yeah. even though PhDs take a lot longer.
Mm-hmm. So what do you wish you could tell your undergraduate self?
Oh, so many things. I was really, 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 I don't know if it, oblivious or ignorant, there was a lot I didn't know about grad school when I was an undergrad. I sort of just had this thought that this is what I was going to do, but I didn't know much. I didn't really have anyone to talk to about it, so I didn't have much guidance when I was thinking about grad school. So that's one of my big pieces of advice, is find someone to talk to. Either a professor in the department that you are doing your major in or whatever you want to pursue. If they are grad students are actually great for getting advice from, because they're usually hooked into what's going on right now. If you find that you don't really connect with anyone at your university, send out emails to people you have been reading in the field. Worst that happens is they don't reply. As long as you're reasonably polite and are just asking for advice, no one's going to get mad about it. And sometimes you'll get really helpful advice. So that's a huge one, is get information from people. Find out what they think are sort of, you know, hot topics in the field, really good programs for pursuing certain things. If there are any programs or departments to stay away from, that sometimes is insider knowledge that you don't really get unless you're part of the discipline. That there are often sometimes some departments that are not great places to be spending time. So that's a huge one. I have more advice if you want more advice.
Do you think it's better to go straight into it, or like take a little bit of time off and, you know, work a little bit?
I know that for me and for a lot of people I know, it was really helpful to take a couple years off. Grad school and undergrad are surprisingly different kinds of things. It seems like it should be something that we're really, you know, prepared for, having done college, and yet the differences are sort of striking, so having that gap is actually helpful. I think that the people I know who have been most successful at graduate school are the ones who are able to kind of treat it like a 9-to-5 job. There's always more work you could be doing, so having some sort of practice at turning it off and doing other things is actually really helpful. So if you've actually been in an office job, I think that's useful. I think it's also useful for expanding your notions of what other options might be. Sometimes people go straight into grad school and then feel like that's the only possible thing they could ever do with their life. And I think that that leads to people feeling a little bit trapped. And that's not so great. So actually having experience with something outside of school is, I think, a little bit useful.
So moving on to women in higher education, I've heard from various professors that in their PhD programs, like a lot of times, the male students will sexually harass them or other women to make them drop out.
It'd be awesome if that were outdated. That'd be wonderful. It depends on what discipline you're in. And I think that this is something that people should do as much as they can to research ahead of time. And this is, again, where reaching out to other folks in the field is helpful. There, in especially in philosophy and some of the STEM fields, in a lot of the fields, there is a lot of sexual harassment. Just a lot of sexism, a lot of sexual harassment. Sometimes it's coming from other grad students. Oftentimes it's coming from faculty. BuzzFeed has a really good series of articles about, actually the ones I pay attention to are philosophy professors who are sort of known sexual harassers or sexual abusers. But so there's more and more pop culture attention to folks who have power and are abusing that power in relation to grad students. That I think is something that's particularly toxic because when you're a grad student, you're something more like an apprentice to faculty. You aren't quite a student anymore, and so you work much more closely, and they have power over you for about a good decade. And so things can go wrong very quickly there. Also, their problem, and also, so then other grad students are sort of taking their cues from how faculty interact, and interact specifically with women grad students, so you get some not great interactions from other grad students as well. You also get pervasive sexism, where folks are sort of underestimating what women have to say or dismissing it or just not hearing it as a contribution at all. It's hard for me to overstate how unpleasant it can be.
How do you manage to get through that? Like, is there any way to combat it? Like, well, you know, like, it's like your superiors at times who are imposing this, or like, how do you handle that?
Yeah. So coalition building is one of the most productive and really awesome things that I can recommend for grad school. So find people to create a support system with. So finding other grad students, different allies, right? So men, women, non-binary folks, whoever is sort of aware and sort of working to help combat this can be a really awesome ally. And so even if it's just having people who you get together with over coffee or drinks or something and are like, this is what happened in seminar today, y'all. You would not even believe it. And just talking to each other and realizing that you aren't alone, that it's not something that you are doing, that like, no, these are pervasive problems. That can be huge, even if it's just venting. So that's one thing, is finding people to vent with. And then sometimes you can't find people in your department. So reaching outside of the boundaries of your own department, maybe to other departments at your university or to other departments at other universities, right? So figuring out people who you can sort of be in solidarity with, I think goes really, really, really far. I go to a lot of conferences, and so I have a lot of conference friends. And so we meet up, where, like, there are people who I see repeatedly at these conferences, and we sort of check in with each other and support each other. It sort of is nice to have someone outside of your department to, again, vent to, or also to get advice from. And so that's huge. Again, just having a support network is huge. And sometimes you can do these targeted strategies. There were a bunch of reports, I think it was last semester or last year, that came out of the Obama administration about how women were working to amplify one another's voices. So one person would make a contribution, and if it didn't really get taken up, you'd be like, well, as Allison said, we should be doing this, and sort of, again, sort of boost each other's voices. And so that's a strategy that I found works really well in seminars, is to take up someone else's point, to make sure that you're referencing who made that point by name, and to be going back and, again, not letting the conversation just gloss over the contributions that women are making. Sometimes it's taken that women are asking clarificatory questions while men are making contributions, and so sort of reorienting the conversation so that, like, no, lots of people can make contributions. So thinking about these different strategies you can utilize, I think, is huge for surviving grad school.
That's definitely a big obstacle to have to deal with, though. Like, data time is difficult already, and then, like, it's, you have some work just to find that support and even, like, acceptance. I feel that's got to be a big challenge.
It's not ideal. At the same time, I think that I've definitely benefited from having these connections to folks in different areas, in different departments. I'm much more hooked into the discipline than I might have been otherwise. So again, like, even though in some ways this is a survival strategy, this kind of coalition building, I think, can also be really, really productive and empowering. So it's not all terrible. Maybe the reasons why we had to start doing this were not so great, but at least some of the outcomes have also been really empowering and really wonderful.
And maybe over time people will start to realize that, hey, like, women actually do have a lot to contribute. Let's start changing this mindset here and make some progress.
Yeah, it seems like we are living at a time where there is so much transformative potential, right? And how cool is it that we can be the generation that actually makes these differences, right? Mm-hmm. That we can usher in this change. I think that that's just ridiculously awesome.
But beyond just like grassroots coalition building, how do you actually change the institution? Because that's, you know, that's where the pervasive sexism is. Mm-hmm. It's coming from the faculty, it's coming top down.
Yeah, so thinking about the places where we have power, and we sometimes have more power than we might recognize, especially as a grad student. If you're teaching your own classes, you get to decide who you're assigning, right? You get to decide whose voices you're centering. When you're constructing your own research projects, again, you get to decide who it is that you're holding up as being worthy of your attention and your time and your energy. And so these are places where we can start to make small differences. There's a group at the Georgetown Philosophy Department. This was started by Megan Dean, who's also a grad student. It's called the Diversifying Syllabi Workshop. And so we have a website where we have a list of philosophical texts by diverse authors. And it's something that lots and lots of people in philosophy outside of Georgetown go to this website to get ideas of what to put on their syllabus. So this is something where, and we have, you know, reading guides for each of these texts to sort of enable people to more easily put diverse authors onto their syllabi. And it's a relatively small contribution. It's something that we enjoy doing, and we do over the summer as we maintain this website. But it starts to have a larger and larger scale impact as more and more people are doing this, right? So that's one thing to do. It's to change the representation of who counts in the field, right? Who we're seeing, whose voices we're hearing. Again, it takes time. And yeah, there's a sense in which you just kind of have to wait out the old guard, but they're not all terrible, right? Like, many of them are also sort of actively invested in this project of trying to make things better. Not all of them, though.
Have you personally experienced discrimination based on gender?
Yeah. It's hard to even sort of pinpoint all of the examples. So some easy ones are when people come up and explain basic ideas to me. You know, the classic idea of mansplaining is alive and well. So I've had people who have only ever taken intro to philosophy explain my dissertation to me, which was, you know, super helpful. I have had people sort of, I don't know if it was intentionally, but at the very least, obviously misconstruing my comments or mistaking what it is that I'm trying to contribute as if I'm saying something that's really, really simplistic or sort of obviously wrong. So giving just like a horrible interpretation to some of these comments, some of the ways that our words get taken up. I mean, that's a pervasive thing. And at this point, I've sort of gotten good at being like, no, that's not what I said at all. I've also experienced sexual harassment. I've also experienced a sort of choose your own adventure. It's happened. And yeah, this is one of those places where knowing other people and getting to vent and talk about it really makes a big difference. So one of the things that happens, as I said, I go to a lot of conferences. One of the things that's really common is at some point, at almost every single conference, either one-on-one or in small groups, usually women will go aside and we'll sort of exchange stories of like, who do you know who is terrible? Who do you avoid? Do we need to avoid them? What kind of problems are there? So again, sort of building these networks of knowledge. I'm making it sound awful. Right? There's also, we also like gossip and joke and like have fun together. But like usually there's at least a couple minutes of sort of doing support work for each other.
Do you ever get that from students, like questioning your knowledge of stuff?
Yeah, that's definitely a thing to be aware of. I think I happen to have lucked out a lot in my interactions with students, that I am often pretty quickly held as being authoritative. I know that a lot of women have the experience of students especially questioning the grades that they assign, much more so than the men grad students experience. And so that's a thing. And also the experience of having students so push back on grades that you assign, question you in class, sort of talk over you. I know some people who get comments on their body when they're teaching, body or appearance. yeah, all of this sort of happens. There's some things that you can do to combat it, and so sometimes faculty are actually really, really good at sort of intentionally utilizing those strategies. One of the things that's been found is that if you introduce graduate students at the beginning of the semester and introduce them by name and say what they're doing and that they have areas of expertise, that makes a huge difference. So starting off by bolstering someone's authority and credibility. And so sometimes faculty knew that ahead of time and would utilize these strategies. Sometimes we had to tell them, hey, it'd be really helpful if you did this at the start of the course. And usually faculty are really, really receptive to that. So thinking about what strategies you can do to sort of, again, like set yourself up or set up others as authority figures makes a big difference in the long run.
That's extremely helpful. Like, I know that already it's in my like first year physics courses. I'm a physics major, mm-hmm. and I've seen students disrespecting our female professor mm-hmm. in this introductory physics class and trying to like discredit her work and like what she's saying. Mm-hmm. So like that just really struck me, where these freshmen mm-hmm. are not able to respect the authority of a professor.
Yeah, and it happens much more than I think we want, but then we wish it would. So just today we were looking at a website that looks at the words that are used in student evaluations on Rate My Professor, and it's fascinating, right? So the word brilliant or genius is overwhelmingly more likely to be associated with a man. The words, what was it, harsh and boring and
caring,
yes, so sort of a positive one,
yeah.
And disorganized. We're more likely to be associated.
And organized.
But we thought it might be because it was not organized. The word organized would show up if they're saying she's organized, or it would also show up if they're saying she's not organized. So it's hard to know what to do with that specific word, because it also showed up for disorganized. Maybe people just don't care if guys are organized. So it just doesn't show up in the evaluations at all. But so you can sort of see that even just going on, you know, Rate My Professor, which is not the most scientific of websites, but looking at the evaluations on there, you get like some stark differences in how people are viewing and evaluating teachers.
That's incredible. I never would have thought that Rate My Professor would be so like revelatory.
I know, it's weird. It's a fun website. I recommend checking it out.
So moving on to your work in philosophy and intersectionality. Can you just define for us what intersectionality is?
Intersectionality is about the interlocking systems of oppression. So this idea that sometimes people are used to thinking about, okay, oppression is either about race, or it's about gender, or it's about disability, and thinking about how instead these mechanisms are entwined and come together. So someone can be experience discrimination or possibly empowerment specifically in their capacity as, say, a black woman, or as a disabled queer white man, right? And so that those experiences are specific to the way that these systems of oppression entwine together.
And can you just tell us a little bit about what you specifically work on?
I work on the ways that we use language to create in-groups and out-groups. And so I'm especially interested in the complicated and nuanced ways that we use language to construct these in-groups and out-groups on the basis of identity. And so sometimes we do things really, really explicitly where we say, I hereby welcome you into our scientists club. I have no idea. But sometimes we do it through like informal jokes, right? Like if you get the joke, if you know to laugh, then you really are an insider. The other things I work on are things about derogatory terms and the different ways that these terms target and impact people. So I work a lot on the word slut, and the ways that that is directed really, really differently at women on the basis of race, age, socioeconomic class, disability, all these different aspects of identity. It's not monolithic, right? Mm-hmm. And the ways that we use these words and direct them towards people set up the norms for interacting with them. And it's really, really hard to get out of that box once someone puts you in it, right? You have to do a lot of extra work. So I'm sort of interested in how the words that we use help structure our social interactions.
So is there any way to kind of like work against that structure? Like kind of like resolve these issues, break down these barriers? Or is it just like once they're there, they're there?
We can definitely work against them. Figuring out how to do that and what's going to be the most successful is, I think, harder. So something that I think we can start to do is to be a little bit more aware of how we use language, right? So whether or not we're using the word lame to describe a situation that we didn't really like, right? Thinking about like, oh wait, that's actually talking about physical disability. Maybe we don't want to equate that with badness. So thinking about sort of the offhand or casual things that we use in our daily interactions, right? And this isn't to say that everyone is a horrible person if you use kind of ableist language, but instead sort of think about how we might be implicated in these systems and thinking about what we can do sort of as responsible people as we go forward in our daily interactions. And so that's one of the things I think is really hopefully empowering. And it's one thing that we can do sort of relatively easily in our own daily lives is to be a little bit more aware of how we use language towards ourselves and towards others.
So in places of higher education and in the workplace, like how should women assert themselves to be seen as authoritative?
You know, I don't think I have one answer to this. Sometimes people have given the answer that you need to sort of adopt these traditionally masculine modes of interaction. So the idea of power posing, I'm doing it right now. I don't know how to describe it. Where you, like, flex your muscles in front of the mirror or something like that. That sort of doing these particular things with your body helps you get into this mindset where you're going to be more authoritative. That's the idea of power posing. One of the problems with this, first of all, the science of it is bogus. But then also, it sort of is encouraging women, to adopt these sort of more traditional masculine modes of behavior. I think that works for some people. I think it really is inauthentic for other people. So my biggest piece of advice is to find the mode of authority that feels comfortable for you. Sometimes people, give this monolithic advice as if there's one thing that you have to do, and I think that that's not a great strategy. There are lots and lots of ways to be authoritative. There are lots and lots of ways to be empowered. And figuring out, trying these different strategies, figuring out the thing that works for you is huge. I also think that one of the things that we can do that matters is to not put too much pressure on yourself. Right? So I think that often many, many women experience what's called imposter syndrome in grad school, where they think that they're just total outsiders, they don't belong there, and then they start to feel shame, they start to feel a lot of anxiety, and it's just like trying to give yourself a break, realizing that it's not just you, that there are these large structural systems of oppression that you might be dealing with, that it's not you that's a failure. Maybe it's our social world that's kind of a failure. But letting yourself off the hook sometimes is, I think, one of the kindest things we can do to ourselves and sort of puts you in a position to claim authority once you're no longer carrying that extra burden. I think it helps.
I've read these articles, on BuzzFeed and stuff that say, women should stop apologizing, mm-hmm. or women should stop using the word just. Like, when you're saying, let me just grab lunch, let me just turn off the lights. Because it makes you seem timid, and it makes you seem like you're asking for permission. And a lot of times, these words or phrases are disproportionately used by women. You don't really see men using these phrases. Mm-hmm. So, do you think we should be aware of that and, avoid it, or,
I think it depends which things we're talking about. So sometimes there's a habit where women are more likely to say, I might be confused, but this is what I took from the reading, right? So trying to stop those strategies of self-undermining is, I think, actually a good idea. In terms of criticizing women for using the word just or for vocal fry, that's another one that women are sometimes told to stop doing. It's what the Kardashians sound like. Actually, I don't know what they sound like, but I've read that. It's where your voice is more crackly. You're speaking the lower register of your voice, and people think it sounds like it makes you sound not smart, is the perception. Turns out it's actually just a gendered thing. They think that when women do it, they sound not smart. Who's it? Ira Glass, who's the host of This American Life, he has vocal fry. No one ever criticizes him for sounding super annoying. It's a super gendered criticism. So I think that there's, again, sort of overarching patterns of criticizing women for speaking, right? It's not just about the way that they're speaking. It really just comes down to speaking at all. I think that there's value in claiming your own mode of authority. So sometimes we're told that you need to limit all of your modifiers and limit the number of exclamation points you use in email exchanges. I sort of intentionally refuse to do that. As anyone who's gotten emails from me knows, there are going to be a lot of exclamation points because this is the way that I speak and this is sort of who I am, and I've decided to be stubborn, and I don't want to compromise that. I think that other people will reasonably make other choices. And so figuring out, again, like what you need to do to survive, what feels comfortable to you. And that's my biggest piece of advice, is to figure out the things that feel authentic to yourself, to figure out the things that you are willing to compromise on, and the things that you're like, no, I'm not changing how I sound, or I'm not changing how I present myself, right? Again, like, there's a certain kind of privilege that goes along with being able to make those choices, but figuring out which choices you are going to make is, I think, a useful ongoing process, both for grad school and other areas of life.
Yeah, I think that definitely, like, staying true to yourself is going to make an impact on, like, how confident you feel in your own skin. Because you feel like you can't even be yourself, how are you going to feel confident as yourself?
Right? Like, if you feel like you're just, like, in costume all the time, right, you're not going to actually feel that authoritative, right? If you feel like you're just absolutely pretending, then of course you're going to continue to feel like an imposter. I think it's worth trying on different modes of authority. I think it's worth seeing, like, okay, this doesn't seem like a great way for me to go, but let's try it for a little while. And then figuring out, like, oh, okay, I can actually do this. I've recently discovered that I actually am comfortable wearing blazers. For a long time, that was my line in the sand. But figuring out, like, which things you can do and sort of, again, still feel like you aren't totally betraying yourself. Because I think that that shouldn't be what we have to do in grad school. I don't think you should have to abandon who you are in order to get through it. And if you're being asked to, that might be a good sign that you should look for a different program.
Do you think that kind of, like, finding that path to confidence can kind of, like, work alongside, like, figuring out, like, who you are as a person? Or, you know, is that what looks like?
Yeah, I think part of it is just a process of living life and traveling through the world, right? I sort of hate the idea of growing up because it implies that you weren't, I don't know, a fully-fledged person beforehand. But, right, like, as you move through the world during college and after college, in grad school if you're going there, sort of, again, it's just this ongoing process of figuring out who you are, which things you're going to really, really value as you organize your life. It might be the case that grad school is the thing that you are all about. It might be the case that, like, ultimate frisbee is really where your passions lie. You might be able to do both, or you might have to choose one over the other. And that's okay. And it's this, again, it's this ongoing process. I think we often have this message that you have to know exactly what you're doing with your life as soon as you graduate, and I think that's a terrible message, right? It sort of sets people up to feel trapped. It sets people up to stay in situations that might not be good for them.
So, it's just terrifying.
Right? I know.
I think there's more recognition of that, like, in mm-hmm. our generation.
Yeah.
Like, at least, like, you know, with, like, the Great Recession and stuff, there's no such thing as job stability yep. anymore in our generation. Like, our parents, they work for, companies for 50 years, and then they retire, and that's their entire lives. And for us, we have 5 different careers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that actually is valuable for us. I know it also is daunting, because it's, like, what are you going to do with your life? But it also means that you don't feel, again, as locked into something. We get to be a little bit more playful, which I think, again, is valuable.
Yeah, like when I hear the majority of people work outside their major, there's, like, there's the scary side to that, but there's, like, okay, still have flexibility to go and do what I want if I change my mind.
Yeah.
There's a certain confidence that goes with that.
Absolutely. I also, so going back to grad school, sometimes there's at least there's this perception that you have to go on this one path, that if you get your PhD in something, especially one of the humanities, that you have to go become an academic. With philosophy, that's very strongly the mindset. But it's not the only option. I know folks who have gotten their PhD in philosophy and now work in hospitals as clinical bioethicists. I know some people who do community organizing. I know some people who do student organizing. A lot of organizing. I know several people who are ontologists and work for computer science, AI companies. So thinking about, like, what are the options outside of the traditional path, right? Whether it's for your major or for what you're doing to grad school for, like, thinking about, like, all of the wide possibilities. I think there's more and more of that, which is valuable.
So wrapping up, like, what is your advice for women going into the field of philosophy or academia?
So, yeah, finding support systems is, I think, a huge and important thing. Finding work-life balance so that all of your self-worth isn't tied up with school or isn't tied up with your major or what you're going to grad school for, I think that's a huge thing. This is a piece of general advice. So I don't think it's just for women, although I think it bears particularly for women, is that many, many people, if you're going to grad school, and especially if you're getting your PhD in something, you're used to being kind of the shining star in that area, right? So when you're in high school, you're probably like one of the good students. When you're in college, you're probably like one of the people who is particularly into your major. You probably did well in those classes. And whether or not you value it a ton, it's at least usually part of your identity, of your self-conception. When you get to grad school, you're around a whole bunch of people who are into the exact same things and are also incredibly good at them. And so not standing out often feels like failure. And I think that women are especially likely to internalize that as failure. But the truth is that, at least especially at the beginning, before people have their own projects, no one really stands out. It's just that when we're used to it, not having that can feel really destabilizing. That's one of the things that I wish I had known going into grad school. That, again, once you're with a whole bunch of people who are interested and good at the exact same things that you, as you, you don't really stand out of the crowd, but that's okay, right? That doesn't mean that you're failing. That doesn't mean that you don't belong. And so sort of having at least a little bit of trust in yourself, or sort of, again, giving yourself a break, I think that that's something that we don't do enough of, is that kind of self-care.
What's your favorite thing about the work that you do?
Oh, my life is awesome. I get to work on shit that I care about, and I get to teach classes with awesome students and talk about things that I think are cool. My life is super cool.
That's a great thing to be able to say. Like, I feel like such a small percentage of people can say that now. So,
right?
Like, that's awesome.
I know. I've just talked about all the terrible aspects of it. My life is rad. I get to, basically, I only do things that I think are awesome, right? Like, it's often a lot of work. I'm very sleep deprived sometimes, but it's all projects, it's all work that I think is interesting, and that is super fulfilling, and at least, I mean, I hope it's other people think this as well, but at least I think it's valuable, right? I think that it's something that matters a little bit in the world, and so I think that being able to say that is just awesome, right? Yeah, my life is cool.
That's incredible. That's so motivating to hear. Like, that really is. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure.
And you're graduating this year, right?
I damn well hope so.
So you're going to be Dr. Cassie.
Yes, I am.
Are you going to make your students call you back?
Absolutely not. I will surely fill out, like, some form or piece of paperwork with the title doctor and then rarely use it again. But, yeah.
It's a big achievement, though. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
I mean, let's save it until it happens, but thank you. Yeah, I'm
very
excited.
We'll listen to this afterwards. Yes, and
yes. Yes, and then it'll feel very, very deserved.
What are your plans for the future?
I don't entirely know, but my strong hope is I really want to be a professor, and I want to have the opportunity to get to continue to teach. I like both teaching, I like both writing. I think that they mutually support each other. And again, how cool is my life that I just get to talk about shit I think is important with other smart people? Right? Like, that's
awesome.
That's absurdly lucky. And so if I get to continue to do some of that, I will be delighted.
All right. Thank you so much for coming on our very first episode.
Thank you.
For those of you listening, follow us on Twitter at George Sloan Boys, or at G Town Boys, rather, at Halftime GU.
My Twitter, if you're interested, is at MLEJaster.
And mine is at KAEI_LI. You can also find us on georgetownvoice.com or subscribe to the Voice Podcast Network on iTunes. Thank you for listening. Bye.